Hello, everyone. My name is Raphael Fischler. I'm the director of the School of Urban Planning. I want to welcome you all to the 2015 annual Brenda and Samuel Gewurz lecture in urban design. Even though the Gewurzes are not here today, I want to thank them. I want to thank the Gewurz Family Foundation for its generous support of this lecture series. We have a very special guest today, a bit unorthodox in a lecture series on urban design writ large, because he does work in this field in some ways, but he comes to this field from a very different angle, from the world of the World Wide Web, from digital media and studies of technology and culture. Adam Greenfield graduated from New York University with an honors degree in cultural studies in 1989. And then he had a series of different jobs: rock critic, bike messenger, medic, parts of it at Berkeley, at the Berkeley Free Clinic, where some of us were also. And then joined the army and for 5 years, and we won't ask him questions about that, he did psychological operations with a unit of the U.S. Army. But I guess he mastered enough skills there to then enter the fray of digital information and a subfield called information architecture, and started working in a variety of positions in a number of different countries. He has lived and worked in the US, in the UK, in France, in Finland, in Korea, in Japan. He's visited Montreal several times. In Japan, for example, he was the lead information architect for the Tokyo office of the internet consultancy Razorfish. And in Finland, in Helsinki, he was Nokia's head of design direction for service and user interface design. In 2010, Adam returned to New York City, where he founded a consulting firm called Urban Scale. And this is how the firm is described on its own website: that Urban Scale is an urban systems design practice with a human-centered orientation, and it has the ambition to improve the quality of metropolitan experience worldwide. It advises on the design of products, services, and spatial interventions wherever networked information technology intersects the urban condition, for the benefit of everybody who lives, works, strives, and dreams in the world's cities. This consulting firm works with municipal and other public sector bodies, private organizations, on the interaction of digital technology and urban experience. They work on interface design, ethnography, graphic design, typography, cartography, software development, etc. Now, in addition to have had all these experiences and being a consultant, Adam Greenfield is also a writer and an academic. He teaches, he writes. He gained much attention, and some of you may know him for that book, the book called Eyewear, The Dawning Age of Eyewear, The Dawning Age of Ubiquitous Computing. He also gained notoriety for his manifesto, which he co-authored with Mark Shepard, entitled Urban Computing and Its Discontents. And more recently, he published a new book called Against the Smart City. In 2013, Adam Greenfield received a Mellon Fellowship in the Humanities to be at the London School of Economics and Political Science in London. And he joined there the LSE Cities Center, which is a center that aims to shape new thinking, I'm quoting, shape new thinking and practice on how to make cities more fair and more sustainable. He was named in 2014 a senior research fellow at LSE Cities, and his mandate there is to explore the role of network technology in the urban experience, in particular in the construction of urban citizenship rather than in the construction of hardware. So we thought that after the IPLAI workshop that we had on the future of the city that Paul Yakhnin organized today, after a day of thinking of the future of the city and in bridging that discussion to issues of urban design, we thought that it would be wonderful to talk about urban design from the perspective of digital technology, which are, whether we want it or not, going to shape our lives, our urban experience. And probably no one was better qualified to discuss this topic, to discuss this issue, than Adam Greenfield. We're very happy that you could be here with us, and I'd like you to join me in welcoming him in this space. Thank you.
Howdy, could you hear me? Yeah, okay, it's wonderful to be back in Montreal. The last time I was here, I was actually dancing with the police in some of the manifestations you had a couple of summers back. I had a friend named Anarcho Panda, and we engaged with the local constabulary. It was an inspiring time for everybody. I can only hope I'm able to be as 1/100th as light on my feet as Anarcho Panda was in the summer of 2012 today. Thank you so much for having me here. Thank you, Raphael, for that extraordinarily warm and comprehensive introduction. The talk today is called Another City is Possible, Practices of the Minimum Viable Utopia. And for those of you who spend any time at all immersed in the literature and the rhetoric of technological development, particularly the Silicon Valley startup, you may recognize the illusion contained within that title. The minimum viable product is a current shibboleth and fetish of the startup community. I'm not at all interested in what they aim to do, which is disrupt things. I'm not interested in disrupting systems that work well. I'm certainly not interested in disrupting structures of justice, equity, and solidarity that people have relied on in cities for centuries. But I am interested in other things about their practice, particularly what they think of as agile development, particularly what they would construct as the state of always being in perpetual beta, of always being approximating some condition rather than having arrived somewhere. And I think we'll get into a little bit later on exactly how I find that inspiring, despite all the baggage that comes with it. As Raphael pointed out, I have for the last year or so been a senior urban fellow at LSE Cities in London. And frankly, I find that title so intimidating and so overwrought that I thought that I had better justify my being there with some pretty concrete and significant work. And you'll have to be the judge as to whether I've succeeded that ambition. But there was something that was made very, very clear to me when I joined LSE Cities, which is that if my inquiry, as Raphael mentions, has been one concerning the question of technologized urbanity, it nevertheless has not been, and certainly will not be in the future, a particularly technical inquiry. The conditions of the fellowship that I was awarded at LSE Cities made it quite clear to me, and everybody else as well, that this was to be an inquiry in the humanities. So if we are indeed looking at networked digital information processing systems, and I think that this is a vastly significant and important field with a great deal to learn and a great deal to teach us about the structuration of order, meaning, and value in cities, our focus nevertheless will not be the particular concrete conditions and nature of systems themselves, but of urban intelligences, subjects, and subjectivities as they arise in the presence, around the use of, and through the revelation of working with these technologies. My job has been to survey the terrain of technologized urbanism as it exists in our time, to look around the world and to see if there's anything that crops up that might support the development of some facets of humanity, of human being in cities that I find particularly interesting, meaningful, and valuable. Practices of very long standing, cultural developments of a very, very long standing. So things like urban solidarity, the networks of resilience that we rely upon when the chips are down, the people that we've invited into our orbit, into our circle of trust, that offer us assistance when we need it and to whom in return we offer assistance. The development of urban competence, and savoir-faire, how we know our way around complex urban spaces, how we learn to be civic, how we learn to be citizens, and how we learn ultimately to be urban people. These are the things that interest me. I think that the presence of networked information processing technologies has inflected each and every one of these conditions as they've existed in every city on Earth in just the past 10 or 15 years or so. I mean, really what we're talking about is a step change in the unfolding of these practices and life ways of very recent vintage. You know, the smartphone era really began in earnest on June 29th of 2007, the day that the original iPhone was launched. That's a mere 8 years ago as we sit here. So we're really looking at things that have transpired over a very, very short interval of time, have had extraordinary impact, and yet have receded almost entirely from our conscious perception. It's a very, very strange set of circumstances we find ourselves among. That this envelope of potentials could have been delivered to us, that we could have received it with such wonderment, that we could have allowed it to transform the way we do citying, and that we could have already forgotten that, forgotten what life was like before, forgotten the difference between the ways in which we used to do things and the ways we do things now, forgotten to hold those things up to critical inspection, forgot to ask whether we like this bargain that we've been offered and whether we're fully comfortable with the implications for our humanity and our ability to manage the world around us and our ability to collaborate with our fellow citizens. This is stunning to me. So this is the nature of my inquiry, is to haul all of these subjects back up into the light, to disinter them from the loam that they settled into, and to ask very pointed questions about them. Now, in doing this, there's inevitably a sense in which I'm amplifying weak signals. Professional futurists use this term of art, this jargon, a lot. We talk about we scan the horizon as we look out on the cities of Earth, and we may very well see things happening in Sao Paulo or in Bangkok or in Cleveland, and we may decide that these things have salience and significance. There's always a danger when doing this that you're cherry-picking something, that you're attending to something with wishful thinking more than clear analytical perception in mind, and that you want it to be relevant, you want it to be material, and you want it to be indicative of some larger trend, when in fact this may not be the case. Nevertheless, you learn over time in doing this that some things bear the early hallmarks of something which might come to be of greater relevance, and you take note of that. So my job is to amplify weak signals, connect the dots, and report back to tell a story about the ways in which we're contemporarily using networked information technologies to transform the urban fabric and our relationship with that fabric. Now, in all of this, in this entire endeavor, I want to get one thing out of the way from the very outset. Ordinarily, when we discuss technologized urbanity at this particular moment in time, there's one overwhelming idea that comes up at the outset. I was talking to a young woman today on Sainte Catherine. I was in a store, and she happened to ask me what I was doing in town. And I said, well, I'm here to give a talk about technology in cities. And she said, oh, you mean the smart city? Like, I was just absolutely flabbergasted, you know, not to take anything away from this young woman. But the idea that this idea, the smart city, could have escaped from the realm of technology, could have escaped from the, you know, the multinational vendors that have originally promoted the idea and the city councils that spend so much time discussing it, it could have escaped into the conversation at large, to the point that I could almost at random walk into a shop and start talking about things and somebody would say, oh, you mean the smart city. That's stunning to me. The first thing I want to do is dispense with the smart city. I have no interest in it at all. I think it's a horrendous misunderstanding of what cities are and what they do and what they're for. And I don't even think it displays a particularly comprehensive or deep understanding of information technology. Now, this is what we're offered in the smart city. This is canonical. This is paradigmatic. This is Masdar City in the United Arab Emirates, municipality, if you will, master planned and delivered entirely by a very small set of organizations, an environment in which technology, information technology, is woven into the fabric of urban place, is woven into every object, surface, and relation that constitutes the city. What we see here, these kind of jellyfish-looking objects, are these remarkable adaptive solar sails, these brise-soleil, which are supposed to sense the light and heat during the day, unfold to provide shade and shelter, and then at the fall of night to autonomously fold themselves up into these kind of organic, beguilingly organic umbrella shapes, and that everything about this place is to be managed for the comfort and convenience of its residents. Now, this has been a vision that almost, you know, an inconceivable sum of money has been poured into realizing on a cleared patch of desert terrain immediately outside the fence of Abu Dhabi International Airport. And it's not particularly enticing to me, but you see how it's meant to be appealing. Nonetheless, this is the reality of the smart city. This is, you know, so Masdar City is literally the city of Masdar. Masdar is the Abu Dhabi Future Energy Company, a wholly owned subsidiary of the government of Abu Dhabi. And in Abu Dhabi, the facts are these. 85% of the population and over 90% of the labor force are, in fact, foreign guest workers, many of whom have their passports retained from them on arrival in the emirate, who have absolutely no civil or human rights, who are subject to every form of physical, psychological, sexual, and economic abuse, and many of whom live in shipping containers like these, behind chain-link fences with barbed wire on top, with foreign professional military companies and outsourced security companies patrolling the site, with the desert sun beating down on the tops of these unsheltered and unshaded metal hutments. This is their life. Again, 85% of the population and over 90% of the labor force. So when we are sold this, we need to remember that the reality is this. And this is not unique to the Emirates. Although the exploitation here is starker and perhaps more severe than it is in other sites on Earth, anytime we're sold the image of the smart city, this relation of oppression seems to follow in its trail. Now, of course, correlation isn't causation, but at some point you do have to ask yourself, if both of these things crop up so routinely, they're found in each other's presence, perhaps they're epiphenomena of some deeper system. Perhaps they're causally related to some deeper mechanism that's operating. Maybe we can identify what that mechanism is. All of the smart cities that have been offered to us so far canonically have been delivered on cleared sites, on what's called greenfield terrain. But there simply aren't enough sites like that on Earth for this to be a profitable endeavor for the companies that are invested in these technologies. And so, of course, they have retrofitted some of the technologies they developed for such sites for cities that already exist. This is a very, very popular image. How many of you, if I could see a show of hands, have seen this image or some version of it floating around? I'm not at all surprised. This is perhaps the single canonical image that represents the smart city in our time. This is the intelligent operations center that IBM built for the city of Rio de Janeiro at a cost of some $40 million. It is what we would think of in the intelligence trade as a fusion center. It's a site at which multiple streams of intelligence are brought together, are subjected to relational analytics and visualization in an attempt to give the city managers a perspective and an anticipatory view of urban dynamics. The idea of bringing all of this information to bear is to get out ahead of real time, to anticipate when traffic or civil disturbance might arise, and to allow the managers to take steps to prevent or forestall that. There is an issue with this. There are several issues with this, but one of them is, if you know anything at all about information technology, if I use the term of art API, does anybody here know what that means? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, around 10. API, application programming interface. An API is a structured conduit that allows one piece of software to talk to another, one technical system to talk to another over the network. If you know anything about information technology, you know that having gathered information from sensors that are woven into the fabric of the city, that are embedded beneath the street surface, having gathered information from oh, sentiment analysis on social media, having gathered information from CCTV cameras and from blob detection and artifact detection and facial recognition software that's installed on the systems that mediate the streams of information from that cameras, you know that having gathered that information, the incremental cost of turning that information around, averting it, and offering it to the citizens and the residents of Rio de Janeiro is close to zero. You could pipe that information out from this center through a million channels to every smartphone and wired device in the city. The fact that that is countenanced nowhere in the Intelligence Operations Center product suggests to me something very distinct about the designer's notions of who this sort of information is for. It's for the administrators of the city and not the people who make the city what it is. And lest you think that these are just the assertions of some bitter lefty academic, I assure you that I have gone through the developer documentation for IBM's Intelligent Operations Center product. I've gone through it in a fair amount of detail. I have looked at all of the troubleshooting manuals and all of the user's guides and graphic information cards that they've designed to allow the operators of the system to make use of it. And something very interesting and very revealing turns up when you do this that says a great deal about exactly how the designers of the smart city conceive of urban behavior and urban dynamics. There is a drop-down menu in the IBM Intelligent Operating Center product that allows you to deploy troops, in their words, this is the explicit language in English in the documentation, to deploy troops to quell manifestations of urban unrest, to restore the city to an optimal functioning. Now, in the case of Rio de Janeiro, very specifically, these are the troops that we're talking about. This is the Special Operations Police Battalion, obviously a heavily militarized force. I don't think you can see it here. The light is a little strange. The logo of the Special Operations Police Battalion is on the side of their armored van. It's a skull with two pirate pistols crossed behind it, indicating that we're not talking about community policing here. Now, this is an organization that's been cited repeatedly by Amnesty International for violations of human rights on the terrains in which it operates. These literally are the troops that are deployed from that pull-down menu. So there is a one-to-one relationship between an emergent state of affairs on all of those screens we saw and the deployment of these troops to a favela, to a neighborhood, an informal community where poor people live. Now, I've given this talk in Rio. I have friends who live there, and they assure me that, you know, I've walked the favelas. I've visited the favelas myself. They assure me that the situation is not black and white, and that the relationship of the people to the police there is more complicated than I can possibly understand, and I'm perfectly willing to grant them that. I don't live there. I don't live in either the favela or what is called the asfalto, the mainstream formal city. I've never been subject to a raid of the Special Operations Police Battalion, nor have I had the Special Operations Police Battalion operate in my interests. But I can tell you that there is something very, very interesting going on when this process is so fundamentally and so concretely linked to this process, and that I think it's worth averting that, making that evident and visible, and discussing that to see if this is truly what we're interested in. I personally don't want to live that way. I don't particularly think that is the way that I would like to see order maintained in the city that I live in and I give my heart to. I don't particularly want to live with any of these systems. I don't think they're, I don't think they're particularly good at understanding what cities are or cities are for, the history of cities, the histories of human habitation in dense places, or the values that make living in a great city what it is. As Raphael noted, I have written a pamphlet with the perhaps unsurprising title, Against the Smart City, in which I go into all of these thoughts in a great deal of detail. And if I haven't convinced you, perhaps you'll have a look at the pamphlet. Maybe you'll find that on the pages of that book, I'm able to make an argument that's more to your liking. Nevertheless, I have this suspicion that when we're talking about network digital information technology, we've taken a wrong turn somewhere. I argue that around about 1945, there began to be a rather triumphal narrative articulated, starting with an article that many of you have perhaps read an article that was published in The Atlantic called As We May Think by a guy named Vannevar Bush. And in this article, Vannevar Bush described an object, an artifact, a machine called the Memex. The Memex was kind of an electromechanical optical library of Babel. It had everything in it. It had limitless access to all the world's information. But even more importantly, it allowed its user to define their own custom paths through that information. It was a vision of all of the information that has ever been generated in human history made available and accessible to anybody on Earth. And that narrative animated half a century's work of development in this field. You know, through Doug Engelbart's 1968 Mother of All Demos, where he demonstrated for the first time the online system and the window mouse pointer that we've all grown so used to. 1968. Okay, he was also doing speech recognition in 1968. This vision is the same one that animated the original Apple Lisa, which many of the technologies of which were incorporated into the Apple Macintosh, imitated by Microsoft, and grew to populate the user interface of the computers that most people in the world now use. Over the course of these seven decades, we in fact achieved that rather utopian vision. Weirdly enough, I mean, when you say it out loud, we have in fact achieved the vision of making all human knowledge directly accessible to just about anybody on Earth at close to zero cost, wherever they may happen to be on the face of the planet. There are still digital divides, economic, psychic, and cultural. They're very significant. They're not going away anytime soon. Nevertheless, the utopian, the Olympian dream that was bound up in this, we realized it. We made it happen. And then we overshot it. And we wound up with this. You recognize this? I shouldn't beat up on this guy anymore. This is an American. This is a guy named Robert Scoble, the ultimate fanboy and something of a moron. Many people paid for the privilege of being among the first users of Google Glass. Robert Scoble, I don't believe he even had to pay. I think he seemed to be such a key communicator and such a person of influence. I think Google probably gave him the glass for free. He proceeded to wear it everywhere, including here in the shower. He's a figure of howling fatuity. I say I shouldn't beat up on him anymore. I probably won't use this slide anymore. He's had a rough year. He's been diagnosed with cancer. He's admitted to abuse in his childhood. I don't think I need to beat up on him anymore. But I think that he's indicative and representative of a certain tendency, particularly a certain male arrested development, adolescent wish fulfillment, having to do with just the neato cool factor of technology without regard for what it does to us, our subjectivity, or the people around us. I think we've taken a wrong turn with this technology. I think we, in fact, have so much technology and so little practical use for so much of it that all we can think to do with it is sell things. I mean, people have heard of beacons, right? Beacons, the emergent technology known as beacons. All anybody can think to do with beacons is issue coupons to the mobile devices of people who walk by them, offering them 15% off their next purchase at Starbucks. You know, we've gone from this heroic animating ambition to 15% off your next coffee, and we've done it in 70 years. Hurrah. I think we've come to a place of lassitude and even, dare I say, moral vacuity. I think more that these technologies are now actively harmful to the development of skills necessary for meaningful participation in a complex, heterogeneous, democratic society, which is to say, this society, as well as the society that I come from, as well as the society that I now live in. Democracy requires of us not merely tolerance of the other, but the ability to interact meaningfully with people that we have very little in common with. It requires of us negotiation, compromise, flexibility, resilience, humor. And I would argue that our information technologies are eroding most of these qualities in the sense that they matter to our performance of democratic technique. We are becoming terribly, terribly self-absorbed. We are creating bubbles, filter bubbles, to use a common expression, in which nothing need protrude the membrane of those bubbles other than information that we ourselves have selected to receive that's already congenial to us. We enter into what the very problematic philosopher Peter Sloterdijk refers as the interautistic foam, in which we lose the ability to meaningfully model the life world of another. We no longer have access to a theory of mind. We no longer have access to a model of the interiority of the other. And we can no longer meaningfully negotiate with them. My students, and hopefully they'll forgive me for using this as an anecdote, are evidence of this to some degree. When they present to me their projects at midterm, they'll bring to me an idea, and very often it'll be a reasonably good idea. They're bright people. They're bright students. They have interesting insight into things. They're clever and they're creative and they're technologically sophisticated. So they'll bring me an idea for a project, and it's a pretty good one, but it's not perfect. It needs work. And I'll say as much. I'll say, you know, there's the kernel of an excellent idea in here, but you need to iterate. You need to develop it. And they'll say, oh my God, you hate it. No, I've got another idea. You know, I can't believe you hate this. You know, I've got another idea. I've got three other ideas. Please tell me which one you like. I'm at pains to convey to them the notion that I didn't hate their idea. I just didn't think it was perfect. And this is emblematic of the kind of people, you know, inside the filter bubble either want to be loved or they're prepared to be rejected, but what they're absolutely not seemingly prepared to do is negotiate. And as far as I'm concerned, negotiation is the crux of what urbanity is all about. If the smart city is erosive of all of these tendencies, if the ways in which we use information technology in urban space are in fact attriting our ability to perform as fully metropolitan individuals, if I'm against all of this, what am I for? Well, I wouldn't be here tonight if I didn't think that despite everything I've said, there's nothing inherent necessary to networked digital information systems that produces these effects. I have to believe that we can use the master's tools to build entirely different kinds of houses. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about tonight. I'm interested in four things. I'm interested in people making data, people making things, people making places, and people making networks. And I'd like to share a little bit about what I mean about each one of these things. So first, people making data. Oh, we've heard so much about big data. We've heard so much from so many about something that most of them understand so little. The idea that you can somehow wrap your arms around the torrent of information that's produced by our encounter with the network and its sensing apertures, that you can use, you can bring analytics to bear on this data in ways that turn up previously unsuspected kinds of knowledge about the world. This is the logic of the age in so many ways. It's something that emerges from the set of techno-social possibilities that we now have at our fingertips. It is absolutely and definitely brought to the practice of citying. It is a technology of knowing, but a very particular and specific kind of technology of knowing. This, for example, is Cisco's notion of what big data looks like in the city. It is a milieu in which work and urban mobility and transit, the home space, the public space, citizen services, the generation and use of energy, the supply and removal chain, where all of these things are mic'd up, wired up, have embedded sensors, are all watched over by machines of loving grace, whose charter and duty it is to gather these things, to centralize the patterns of fact in them, to apply analytics to them, and again, to allow administrators a couple of seconds respite against real time so they can proactively modulate and anticipate urban behavior, bringing predictive analytics to bear. It is a technology of remote observation and control. And let me tell you that it produces beautiful artifacts. It produces gorgeous, beguiling, and seductive artifacts like these two visualizations from the MIT Sensible City Lab. I mean, when you look at urban place, especially when these visualizations are dynamic, they have the same order of beauty that any large, complex, adaptive system has. If you look, you know, at schooling fish, or if you look at a murmuration of birds, if you look at any dynamic, complex, adaptive system on Earth or beyond Earth. They have a characteristic kind of beauty, and these visualizations do as well. It's one of the reasons why they're so seductive. But, you know, again, we know that the map is not the territory, and yet we forget that when we look at these. This is a visualization of, I believe, of SMS traffic following a Madonna concert in Rome. Now, I don't really know what it tells us. I've been looking at this visualization. I think this visualization dates back to about 2007. I've been looking at this visualization a long time. I still have no idea what it means or what it could mean. Nevertheless, MIT Sensible City Lab trots it out in most of their presentations, in their credentialing process, when they go to talk to municipalities about the consulting contracts they want to win. I don't entirely understand what's being implied in this visualization, but I know there must be something in it, or at least that's what municipalities seem to believe, because they will engage this group of people time and time again to do things with sensors and access to SMS traffic and access to microwave signal repeaters and access to embedded wires beneath the streets to produce visualizations like this that are actionable in what way precisely, I'm not sure. But this is how big data is used to understand urban dynamics. In all such visualizations, all such representations, there's always the question of provenance. And this is something I find very interesting because it's almost never remarked upon. I have had an IBM senior data scientist, so somebody very senior in the organization with the word data actually in their job title, be so unwary and so unwise as to argue to me in so many words, the data is the data. It says what it says. This person appears to believe that data is serene, is eternal, is Olympian, is untouched by the grubby importunments of human want. But, you know, I can return a different temperature value for this room by locating a sensor 2 meters higher than it might otherwise be placed. I can return to you different values for a question I ask by modulating the order of words in the question, by using hot button phrases or by choosing not to use them. I can put my thumb on the scale in a million different ways. The data, as we know, is never just the data. It's always and always already, if you'll forgive my use of that overused term, it is always already political. And we forget that at our peril. So I'm really interested in this question of provenance. Where does the data come from? Particularly, who made the data that comprises big data? How was it gathered? Was it gathered using a device? There's a beacon selling you 50% off that pair of slingbacks. They're not slingbacks? What are they? I can't even see them. Thank you. You're right. How was it gathered? Was it gathered using this sort of device, or was it gathered like this? These are two volunteers for an organization in Haringey, one of the districts of London. The organization's called Living Under One Sun. It was founded by an Iranian-British immigrant, a woman named Leila Laksari. Leila was given a grant to study patterns of mobility in her council, in her district. But Haringey is a poor neighborhood, and so she was explicitly, you know, she was given a budget that was about 10% of that given to the neighboring district. And the argument that was made for the reason why that budget was so much lower was explicitly that her district was comprised of poor people, and poor people are limited in their choices. We already know how they're going to behave. We already know they're basically going to take the bus. They're not interested in doing much of anything else. So we'll give you a budget, but you know, we're not going to give you very much. And what Leila Laksari decided to do with this money, you know, was to some degree limited by, you know, having a very tight purse to operate from. She hired volunteers. Instead of hiring an IBM or a Cisco or a Siemens or an Intel to come and spackle her district with sensors or to design algorithms to do relational analytics and sentiment analysis on Twitter, she hired people to go door to door. And the particular kind of people she hired matter very greatly. She hired at-risk youth. She hired pensioners, people who are out of work, people who hadn't been in employment for many, many years. And she didn't pay them a whole lot. I mean, she may have paid them £10 an hour or something on that order. Now, that stretched her budget a good long way, and it may have made more of a difference in these people's lives than anything else since then. For some of these people, this process of gathering data was the first time that they had been meaningfully employed in their entire lives. Did they return data of at least similar quality to the neighboring districts? Yes, they did. Did they return data that was useful to the study? Yes, they did. It turns out that people in Haringey were amenable to what's called modal transformation, modal split. They were willing to consider bicycles or walking to work rather than public transit. So completely falsifying the assumption that the municipality had come in with. But something else happened. In this process of these people going door to door, they met and encountered their neighbors for the first time. They communicated with them across lines of ethnicity and language and class. They had a sense of themselves as being involved in some sort of common enterprise. They may have perceived themselves as having been bound by a common history and aspiring to a common destiny. So it matters deeply how we gather the data that we import into our models of the world, because that work makes something new of us, something new and something different. Similarly, these are women in a project called Transparent Chennai. They were living in a slum community in which there was only one toilet available for some 10,000 people. And they decided to use OpenStreetMap and personal devices to map the catchment basin that sanitary facility drew upon, to map all of the people who had to share this one toilet. And this was a real issue for them, because when there's no safe place to conduct your bodily functions and your bodily hygiene, life gets miserable very, very quickly. We're all familiar with the Maslowian pyramid of needs. Imagine subsisting at the very bottom of that pyramid of needs, not because the material circumstances don't permit it, but because a decision has been made that you're not entitled to use that. And what this results in the particular context of Chennai is women banding together at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and making a mad dash to the toilets together, because that's the only time that they feel safe in doing so. What it means is that people are denied the very basic lineaments of their humanity. When they can come together and use network technologies, not particularly sexy ones, not particularly glamorous ones, not particularly expensive or elaborate ones, but use network technologies to develop their own account of their place, to develop their own representation of their neighborhood, not the representation that MIT Sensible City Lab or IBM imposes upon them, but a map of their own perception of space and time and the body and the interrelation between those two things. They come to political agency in a sense of their own capability in ways that they hadn't before. These women were able to take these maps to the government and make demands on power in ways that they hadn't felt confident of doing before there was an artifact that substantiated their claims. They made that artifact themselves. They brought that artifact to the government. They said, here, this place is filthy. We have no place to shit. We need more. We need better. We deserve better. And we demand better. And, you know, it turns out, not to be a hippie about it, but it turns out that that was effective, at least in this one limited instance. It turns out that they were able to make that demand on power successfully. And because they were able to come together and make maps and bring those maps to, bless you, and bring those maps to the managers of place, they were able to enact change in their environment. So if we are to live under the eye, the watchful eye, of a conglomerated, aggregated, anticipatory model of place that's built on 10 million points of data, we should at very least insist that we make that data ourselves, and that those representations of our environments include our sense of our relationship to the urban fabric and our place within it, our demands upon it. Nothing else is acceptable. Nothing less is acceptable. Let's talk a moment about people making things and a process that I like to think of as adaptive upcycling. This is an image that will be familiar not merely to anybody who's ever lived in what is quaintly called the Global South or the developing world. This is actually an image from China, but I've seen the same image more or less to within a first pass approximation on the streets of New York City. This is a woman engaged in the repair of everyday objects. She exists within a culture of repair that we've begun to slip out of. But for virtually since the beginning of cities, we've always had to repair the things around us in preference to buying replacements. When something became too worn for fitness for purpose, we needed to invest time, energy, and resources in repairing it. We now have access to extraordinary ways of doing a culture of repair that bring us beyond a place in which we're merely ameliorating reality, but we're actually improving upon it. This is what I call adaptive upcycling. Adaptive upcycle is when we take digital fabrication technologies like CNC milling machines, water jets, laser cutters, 3D printers, and we take those rapidly cheapening distributed technologies of production, and we couple them with networked repositories of freely downloadable specifications for material artifacts. This is a screenshot from something called Thingiverse. This is from a woman named Laura Lee Walker. These are some of the millions of things for which digital specification files have been uploaded to Thingiverse that you can download for nothing. They exist in the common domain. They're public domain. You can go and grab them right now. You can take those shape files and you can input them to the technologies of production we were talking about, and you can basically, for fairly low cost, for fairly low energetic investment, and for fairly low material and environmental impact, produce things of acute need and relevance. When this technological prospect isn't merely asserted as an abstract, but is in fact deployed in small, clean city center workshops under democratic community control, I argue to you that we have the basis of a completely new technics of citying, a completely new way of making the material substrate and infrastructure that undergirds everyday life. Now, what might that look like? Here's a very, very basic example. Here's somebody who had an internal combustion engine mounted on a motor mount, which is that ever so slightly glow-in-the-dark looking wedge beneath the bolted plate there. That motor mount, the original motor mount, had degraded over the course of many years. And because that part was no longer available, the entire mechanism had to be deadlined. It was withdrawn from service. It was no longer useful. So you have to imagine that all of the material energetics that's bound up in that, the investment of time and resources and capital that went into bringing this machine to bear on somebody's problems, were wasted. Somebody would have had to buy another motor. For want of a nail, the kingdom was lost. Except now somebody could look that part up, download a free specification for it, and print it out for the cost of a few cents worth of filament in a distributed and local way, that they were able to return that machine for service in their community and to do with it whatever needed doing. Similarly here, we have another. Unfortunately, these examples are both internal combustion engines. I'm aware of some of the liabilities of that. This is a gas cap on a lawnmower. Again, this particular sized gas cap had gone missing many years before, and without it, the machine could not be operated. It's amazing to think of, you know, what a few pennies of plastic worth of difference could make, but you would either have to replace the entire artifact replace the entire machine if you couldn't replace this cap. Fortunately, somebody was able to find a specification for a threaded cap of exactly the right size, print it out, again, literally for pennies, and return the machine to service. These technologies aren't limited to the repair of the very smallest scale artifacts. Here is something called WikiHome, where a similar specification pattern is used with large-scale laser cutters and CNC milling machines to produce structural timber for houses. This is WikiHouse for Rio. Here, a 3D printer is being used in Shanghai to produce the structural elements of structures like this, houses. Less mass, more data. Now, I'm not suggesting that these things are a panacea. I'm not suggesting that these technologies are a solution to each and every problem that the world has. As a matter of fact, many cities, particularly the cities of the industrial north in England, where I work, live, and teach now, their problem isn't so much a shortage of space, it's an abundance of space that's been abandoned, underutilized, and has gone to decay and rot. So I don't necessarily see that popping out 1D, 3D printed house after another is necessarily going to solve the problems of Sheffield. But even for the environments that these technologies were devised and designed for, there's problems and issues. If you've spent any time at all in favelas or Getchakandu or slums, you will have learned most likely that there are people within those communities whose job and whose identity it is to repair the structures that people live in, you know, who are really, really good at sourcing, you know, aluminum siding or tin sheeting or plastic tarps or carpentry, you know, who are absolutely necessary to structure in that community, who make a living doing this and who derive a fair amount of their personal sense of self and competence from doing this. The moment you drop a 3D printer into a community like that, you transform that fabric of relations. You may deprive that person of a job. You may deprive them of their economic viability, and you probably deprive them of their identity. So I'm not saying that you parachute these machines into every slum on Earth and they solve all problems at once, but I'm saying that they are the node and the nub of a different way of doing things that people, at least theoretically, may have local distributed control over, that they can use in ways that are more consonant with their perception of their own needs and the physical envelope of constraints and conflicts that they have to manage in designing their physical community. I think we can see our way through towards purposive, conscious, you know, digital fabrication is an element of a conscious socio-technic ecology. I think it underwrites virtues of self-reliance and competence, and most importantly of all, it tends to underwrite what we would call psychologically an internal locus of control, where instead of feeling like we're pushed to and fro by winds and forces beyond our ability to constrain or command, we have some ability to choose our own futures ourselves and to bring those futures into concrete being. These things between them constitute a technology of conviviality, not merely in the sense of conviviality of getting together and enjoying one another's company, although I also do mean that. Conviviality in the deeper sense of being able to live together. These technologies coupled to the network, coupled to logics of distribution and decentralization, have extraordinary potential to put the power of transforming physical place and reality into the hands of ordinary people around the planet, and I have to imagine that's a very good thing indeed. Let's step up a level of scale to the notion of people making places. The characters on the screen, who recognizes those? None? Nobody? Somebody going to tell me what the first character is? Somebody's got to know what that first character is. Gold, that's right. Gold. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about what that is and what that means. For many, many years now, the orthodoxy in urban planning has been that density is good, that densification is good, and therefore, if we are to recuperate the sprawling, low-density urban environments that the internal combustion engine, the automobile, and the freeway gave us in the 20th century, we're ultimately going to have to subject those environments to a process of infill. We're going to have to fill them back in. We're going to have to fill up the spaces in between them with housing and the other elements of urban place. We've also heard for the last several years a notion of urban acupuncture, that given the material constraints upon actors who are intervening in cities, it is probably best to do very, very sharp, targeted interventions that have disproportionate effects so that you can make injections of program into place, so that you can inject a vertical gym into a slum community and step back and watch as that gym transforms people's sense of place and possibility. I don't necessarily disagree with either one of these notions. I think both densification, you know, and in and of itself is, I like density, and I think density is environmentally responsible, but I don't think it's a solution to everything. Urban acupuncture, again, I think the notion is sound. I think the notion is occasionally interesting, but I don't think it's a solution to everything. I think that we need to supplement these notions with a third notion, at the very least, which is the notion of urban kintsukuroi, which is a word from the Japanese pottery tradition. Kintsukuroi, also known occasionally as kintsugi, means golden repair, and this is what it looks like. This is an image that you may have seen on Wikipedia. Somebody has dropped this ceramic vessel. It's shattered and it's been repaired with seams of molten gold. The notion is that this is not just a restoration of the function of the original, but an improvement upon it, that it has been rendered once more useful, but also perhaps more beautiful than it was before. And this is an insanely provocative notion to me when coupled with the technologies that we've already begun to discuss. This was the city center of Aarhus, Denmark, several years ago. This is a freight rail spur called Godsbanen that pokes up into the center of town. And after the national railways stopped using it, after, I guess, as you know, was the case most everywhere else, most freight started to go on articulated container trucks, no longer went on the railways. There was no need for a rail spur into the center of town and a goods warehouse, so it was abandoned. And again, as such things tend to do, it fell into disuse and disrepair. This is the same site today, after a process that I would regard as Urban Kintsukuroi has taken it over. This is an enterprise called the Institute for X, which has transformed the site using available materials. So you can see a lot of the ubiquitous shipping pallet being used here as seating and as structure. Absolutely fascinatingly transforming the site. Here's another picture of the far end of Godsbanen today, where the environment... Oh, man, I wish that bright light wasn't shining on the screen. Because just as I couldn't see what kind of shoe that was before, now I can't see what the hell I'm looking at here. Well, it's a nice... You'll have to trust me that it is a lovely landscape of containers with grasses growing in them and even, you know, a windmill and some other stuff going on. Very, very interestingly done. But the really interesting innovation on the site is the transformation of the warehouses. They've been turned into a series of workshops. Here, for example, is a looks like a fabric workshop. But there on site, there are photography studios, metalworking shops, ceramic shops, woodworking shops. There's even places where people can learn to DJ. And interestingly enough, there's two different versions of most of these facilities. It's a longitudinal site. And as you start at the far end, where the administration building for the railway company used to be, there are public offices in there. And close to that end of the site, there are workshops with state-of-the-art equipment, which are expensive. You know, they cost some money to use. They're heavily supervised. You know, you're basically, there's a fair amount of watchfulness at that end of things. Here, a laser cutter was used with a freely downloadable specification, mind you, to make what I regard as a fairly comfortable and nice-looking chair out of flat-pack wood. But as you get further down the site, there is a replication of function, but not necessarily a replication of social structure. The equipment tends to be a little bit older. There's no supervision. You take the risk on yourself. You take the responsibility on yourself. And you produce things which are less formal, less regulated, look more like this, but in some senses are more open-ended and give rise to different kinds of possibilities. And the beautiful thing about this site is that you can traverse it in either direction. So you have city center on-demand digital fabrication, but you also have a gradient of structure so that if you start with a casual interest in something, you can tinker around on machines which cost nothing to use, where nobody's watching you or telling you how to use it or what to do with it. And should you find that you have a taste for it or your capacities demand newer and better equipment, you can move down to the more formal and structured end of the gradient. Similarly, if a structured enterprise uses the very highly ordered end of things, but they want to send out a probe that requires a different kind of approach to materiality, if they want to use what Stuart Brand might have thought of as the low road, they can use the low road on the same site. They move further out towards the Institute of X end of things. They take advantage of the freedom that those facilities offer them. This combination of ideas and the repair of the site itself fulfills a more general need. It fulfills a need that we see just about everywhere on Earth that's been transformed by the Industrial Revolution. I will make comments that are specific to the industrial cities of the British North, but in fact and in truth, they're relevant to a lot of places, including perhaps some places you might be familiar with. This is Manchester in the 1860s, Manchester, United Kingdom. It was the cradle and the heart of the Industrial Revolution. And this is Manchester today. Because late capitalism happened, because technology happened, and because of the ways in which we use technology happened, we de-densified and depopulated Manchester, with the result that it became a place of very little hope. It led, I would argue, directly to a sense of a lack of investment in the community, a lack of psychic investment in place, and towards what the British call antisocial behavior. These are young gentlemen who have been issued antisocial behavior orders, which is the way that they deal with social frictions in the United Kingdom. I believe that when people have nothing that they can feel any sense of allegiance to, when they feel nothing that offers them any sense that they are productive and competent individuals that have something to offer, I believe when people have no sense of the relationship between themselves and the trajectories of the communities in which they live, you wind up getting anomie, entropy, and self-destruction. You wind up getting, by definition, antisocial behavior. But I believe if we can use the technologies of people making data and people making things to make place, if we can transform sites like this, abandoned, underutilized, urinated on, vomited on, and forgotten, into active, productive sites of less mass, more data production, where things of use and value are made under democratic community control, producing competent, knowledgeable people with a sense of internal control and some kind of ability to contour their own destiny, well, I think we can do many things. I think, firstly, we generate direct economic benefit. I think we generate something that I think of as almost analogous to what we used to economically call import substitution. So instead of buying things, instead of sending our capital and our investment outside the community to bring material things in, we can begin to produce things locally, and we can begin to produce expertise locally, and ultimately begin to produce place locally. I think we can begin to serve actual needs and not artificially propagated desires. I think we can surface an active community which is profoundly interwoven with the notion of capacity building. Capacity building at the personal and at the social scale. And I think that we need do nothing more than understand what these technologies are and how they can be used to begin to couple them in networks with these values embedded in them. This is not at all the smart city. It's a completely different way of making places. It's an actual notion of a city as meshwork. And that brings us to the notion of people making networks. I think in all of this, I've discussed, you know, bottom-up, self-organized, do-it-yourself logics of production. There is inherently a danger of over-valorizing DIY. I don't mean to fetishize it. I come from punk rock myself. I come from the fanzine, you know, the Xeroxed, stapled, and hand-distributed fanzine and poster. I come from the notion that, you know, the people up on stage are no better or more talented than the people in the audience, and that tomorrow night the people in the audience will, in fact, be the people on the stage. I come from all of that. So I believe in that down to my very bones, but I think there are some things that it can't do. And there are some things that top-down, command and control, design organizations are very good at. For one thing, they're good at acting at scale. They're good at acting at scales of complexity and territorial scales that are far beyond the ability of most bottom-up groups to begin to address. They're good at things which require coordinated and continued manifestation of technological sophistication. I mean, if I want to make a wastewater treatment facility in my community, I had better hope that there is a Siemens or a similar actor out there with that knowledge, with that experience, and with that expertise at delivering these systems at scale. Because the tacit knowledge which is bound up in that experience can't be replicated trivially or easily, no matter how motivated your local group is. I think there are issues of expense, and I think there are issues of coordination at metropolitan scale that these groups are good at. Clearly, you know, the logics of networks, in fact, occasionally militate for the top-down imposition of things. If you want to have a bike path network that serves this entire municipality, it doesn't make very much sense to allow each block to vote separately on whether or not they want to be a part of it. If you want to realize the network effects, you have to allow the network to have at least some linkages that are coordinated and continuous throughout the entire space of action. So top-down organizations are good at some things, and you want them to be a part of things. Nevertheless, if we're talking about digitally sites that are digitally connected, I think we can begin to knit together the logics and the dynamics of bottom-up DIY with top-down design to produce entirely new kinds of outcomes. What we need to do is think sensitively about how to use network technologies to allow groups to organize and to percolate upwards in terms of scale, but also of impact, in ways that allow them to function as elements of a citywide meshwork of similar groups. We need to allow groups that start at this scale of activists, again, you can't see them, activists in Istanbul discussing uses for public space, a group of maybe 6 or 7 people. We need to help them get to this scale if they wish to. This is a group of Brooklyn-based activists discussing what to do with abandoned lots. They are clearly on the order of about 20. To this group of people in a neighborhood on a hillside in Colombia, there may be 50 or 60 people there discussing participatory budgeting and the future of their community. To allow them to coordinate effectively at this scale, El Campo de Sabata in Madrid, where hundreds of people have taken over an abandoned development site, again, that was falling into disrepair. They have reclaimed, recuperated it, and begun to use it for their own purposes. Finally, to this scale of Occupy Wall Street, where thousands or tens of thousands of people participated in activities of democracy that the smart city has no way of treating as anything but a disruption to the orderly and smooth flow of optimal experience. How do we allow groups of each one of these scales with only the skills and experiences that they have access to coordinate with one another? Well, in part, I think we do so by literally teaching people how to make networks. Communications and computation networks, wireless, ad hoc, mesh, available, forming as they are needed and ceasing to exist the moment they're no longer needed. These are activists of the Red Hook Initiative, literally learning how to wire a microwave relay station for a wireless information network. But that's not all we need. I think these technical skills are fantastic, and this is a critical part of everything I'm talking about. But the truth is that not everybody will want to learn how to do this, can learn how to do this, has the time or energy to learn how to do this, and not everybody should have to. But we do need network tools to allow us to make decisions. Everybody needs to participate in that. What we need is deliberative technologies. What we need, in fact, is to develop an architecture of participation based on network tools and processes. Now, as it happens, people who are involved in the Occupy movement have begun thinking about this. They've begun thinking, well, you know, we would like to have a group where everybody is invited to participate, to deliberate, to determine the future of their own community. But the social truth is that many of us have pressures upon us that prevent us from doing that. You know, a lot of us have demands on our time and energy. A lot of us have the responsibility of care for others. A lot of us cannot afford to spend our time and our energy at large group public meetings, you know, actively debating the purpose and the meaning of our future for 7, 8, 10 hours with a bunch of total strangers in the rain. So what if we could use our technologies to open up the scope of those conversations? I don't personally think there's any replacement for the face-to-face, eye-to-eye, physically co-present and co-authenticating encounter with the other that is urbanity to me. But I do think that our networked information technologies have begun to give us ways in which we can temporarily and occasionally extend the orbit of participation in ways that are salient and productive. This is a tool called Lumio, developed in New Zealand by a veteran of the Occupy movement, used here precisely in a challenge about what we should do about a vacant lot at the end of our street. So you're able to use this technology to specify issues of concern, to advance positions as to what should be done about these issues of concern, and to begin to vote on them in ways that may either be straight up and down votes in simple majorities, or may, depending on the settings of the application, require supermajorities or even complete consensus. Similarly, another tool, InterTwinkles, explicitly and obviously inspired by the Occupy movement. If you know anything about the name Twinkles, this is an up-twinkle. This is how we expressed approbation and appreciation in Occupy. I agree with this. I disagree with this. I'm blocking this. This dynamic has been made digital here. Again, very similar dynamic. You can specify areas of concern. You can propose things. You can promote them. You can vote on them. What I think these technologies begin to point us at is something very interesting. They do still tend to collapse down to that vote. There's sort of a collapse of the possibility function of an active, real, live set of circumstances down to a vote. And I don't actually think that's democracy. My particular take is that democracy is a process. It's not an event. It's certainly not something that happens once every year or once every 2 years or once every 4 years. We live democracy. We enact democracy in everything we do. I think these applications and services have begun to point to that. I think that by making disputation, discourse, and negotiation about the things of everyday life something that is much more transparent, available, persistent, by allowing records to form of our decisions over things over time, and allowing us to track the success of those propositions, I think we have the potential components of a new conception of democracy. I think these things are, however, based on a certain understanding of what a network technology is. As far as I'm concerned, they're based on a particular notion of robust, decentralized, and well-assimilated technologies. So, not the embedded sensors and not the advanced algorithms so much yet, but the tools that literally upwards of 90% of the adults on the planet already have access to. A mobile phone, whether it's a smartphone or not, SMS, email. These are the technologies on which our conceptions of democracy ought to be founded, because urban democracy necessarily means that each and every competent member of the community can at least in principle contribute. There's no sense in imposing a new digital divide that draws a circle around who is able and allowed to participate and who is not. We have to found these services on the most robust and most well-assimilated technologies possible. Commodity devices, reliable access to connectivity, assisted where necessary by people who have trained themselves to make networks. Better generic cloud services. When I was with Occupy Sandy, one of the things that I realized was that the entire Occupy Sandy disaster relief and recovery effort, which was widely understood to be more efficient than either the American Red Cross or the Federal Emergency Management Agency, relied entirely on two things. It relied on a repurposed Amazon wedding registry, the wedding of Sandy and Sandy, to which people sent gifts, which were delivered to the church operations center that we had turned into a distribution warehouse. And it relied on a single, gigantic Google Docs spreadsheet. So these are the sorts of generic cloud services that collaboration and participation can be built on. But neither one of those things was ever intended for these purposes. They were designed with a particular set of outcomes in mind. So we need better generic cloud services. If we have these three things, commodity devices, reliable access to ad hoc as needed connectivity, and better generic cloud services, we can begin to transform urban politics and urban place into collectives of data-making citizen actors, collectives of thing-making citizen actors, collectives of place-making citizen actors, ultimately collectives of networked-making citizen actors. What would that look like in practice? Here's a very, very small illustration. When I was researching the Red Hook Initiative, when they were mounting an antenna on a rooftop, I saw that they needed a mounting bracket. And this is a commercial component. It's not particularly expensive, but neither is it free. It's on the order of $100 to get that mounting bracket, simply to mount an antenna on it. But then I thought, well, that's a fairly generic shape. There are probably specific torsional rigidity requirements of that aren't satisfied by this piece. But it took me 5 minutes of searching to find a freely downloadable, printable specification on Thingiverse for something that begins to approximate the kind of material support you'd need to develop networks. When you combine these notions of people making their own data, people making their own things, people making their own places, and people making their own networks, when they additively and even multiplicatively come together, you have the potential for some really transformative things. Can it be done? Has it ever been done? Has anything like this ever been done? Yeah, actually it has. We've spoken a little bit about Occupy Sandy. Here are a couple of images of the Brooklyn Church, one of the two Brooklyn churches that were transformed into relief material distribution hubs. Again, by people who had no prior experience of logistics, picking and packing, or delivery. People had no prior experience in disaster relief and recovery operations. People who had absolutely none of the professional skills or background that they would require. People came together, guided by a very, very few people who had skills that were sort of cognate with some of the things that were required. And from the bottom up, built an extraordinarily effective and efficient disaster relief and recovery operation. Similarly, in Detroit, when on the order of hundreds of thousands of houses were cut off, had their water supplies cut off for non-payment of bills, a group called the Detroit Water Brigade came together and began thinking about how you would do a water distribution infrastructure in a contemporary North American city from the bottom up. Now, fortunately, the water to those people's houses was turned back on by public demand before they actually had to instantiate this. So, you know, the idea that they've satisfactorily resolved this problem, I could understand if you don't regard that as a particularly good demonstration of it. Perhaps you'll be more convinced by this. During the Spanish Civil War, the anarchist CNT Union, the syndicalist, so this is a streetcar in Barcelona, the red and black flag of the anarchist syndicalists has been repainted on it. The CNT Union took over the operation not merely of public transportation, but also of the telephone exchange. And they did so successfully for something on the order of 6 or 7 months. So until they were bombed and shot out of existence and exterminated by the fascists, a bottom-up, untrained organization comprised of ordinary citizens and industrial workers was able to come together and operate technological infrastructures of a fair amount of complexity and sophistication. They were able to bring their skills and their life knowledge to bear on these challenges, and to do so in ways that resulted in the satisfactory delivery of these highly sophisticated services over time. Again, you may not be satisfied with that one example, and I do think that it is somewhat telling that in my search throughout human history, space, and time for examples of this, these are the best I'm able to come up with. I understand skepticism on these counts. Nevertheless, I think the potential is there. We'll come back to the word potential in a moment. And I think that the potential upside is so significant that it's certainly worth investigating these tendencies further. This brings us to our conclusion toward a new stable state. At the very beginning of the talk, I talked about something that tech startups really understand and understand very well. It's part of their ideology of agile development. They release minimum viable products that are in perpetual beta. These are not meant to be finished products. What they're meant to be is probes that are then adopted by an audience, and in the act of being adopted by the audience, you gather data about their use. You gather knowledge and understanding about people and what their reaction to this particular proposition is, what uses they will come up with, how they understand this technology, what they do with it in their everyday life. That knowledge is re-imported back into the product, and it's iterated over time. It is rapid, iterative, continuous development. I would argue that the smart city is a really weird and ahistorical take on technology. It's presented as sort of a fixed future, if you will. It's presented as an achievable end state. But once it's achieved and shipped and delivered, it's supposed to be static. In a way that I can tell you information technology never is. How many people in this room have updated their operating system on their desktop or laptop or tablet or phone in the last year? How many people have suffered when a version of an application you rely upon is deprecated and you either have to upload or download something new, a fix for it, you need to wrangle that technology? Technology, information technology, is subject to a constant process of iterative evolution and churn. the future in the sense that it's presented to us by the ideologues of the smart city never arrives. So we need to understand that our cities will necessarily, as long as they are informed and given life by information technology, they will be in perpetual beta. They will never look like this or this. Finished, perfect, serene, gleaming, clean. But they may look like this. They may look like an allotment garden. Now, why are allotment gardens interesting to me? Well, they're messy. And anybody who's ever worked in an allotment garden knows that they're fairly contentious. Everybody who volunteers there or has leased sites in a shared allotment knows that everybody there has different ideas about shared space. Everybody there has different ideas about what should be planted. Everybody there has different ideas about investments that should be made or needn't be made or must be deferred. They require a lot of really irritating negotiation with some fairly tendentious people. They're unfinished, and they're never to be finished. They're not designed to be perfected. They're designed to be productive, however. They are a place where things are growing, and those things have utility, value, and worth. And if you have an eye for it, those things are beautiful, and those places are beautiful, and the things that are done there are resonant and meaningful far beyond the ability of most of the things that we do in our lives to fertilize our sense of ourselves and our sense of our own potential. But there's that word again, potential. You don't necessarily need to have read Bruno Latour or to think much at all about actor network theory to understand the validity of the point that Latour makes when he says that we should never talk about potential. There are states of systems, and those states, they may be possible, but they're either enacted or not yet enacted. And if we perceive a possibility, to discuss it as a future potential state is meaningless unless we actually put in the work necessary to test the system. Latour calls this a test of strength, a trial of strength. We need to flex the ligatures of the system to see if it will function as we believe it can. We need to attempt to enact a future possible state to see if, in fact, it was potential or was wishful thinking. We need to put work in, and that work is always an investment of time, resources, and energy. And given that there will necessarily be people opposing you very often, that work has the quality of a fight, a struggle. But if we believe in these possibilities, if we find that these possibilities offer us value and meaning and beauty that our current lives and our current contexts are not offering us, then perhaps it is worth that work, that investment, and that fight. In fact, we might realize together, between us, in our lifetimes, a city worth fighting for. Take care of each other, and thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very, very much for this very inspiring, thorough talk. We have a bit of time left for questions from the audience. In order to see the audience, I'm going to flip a switch.
Oh, you should have warned people.
I thought I was warning you. I was going to flip a switch. Excuse me. So we have a bit of time for questions and answers. I'm going to use another mic here, which I'm going to circulate to people who want to ask questions. When you ask a question, I ask you to use the mic and to identify yourself. Otherwise, you will not be on camera.
Camera. Maybe you don't want to be on camera.
Sam Goldberg, a McGill alumnus and retired history teacher. If one approaches this historically, whether one talks about Louis Blanc or Robert Owen, whether one talks about the kibbutz movement in Israel, whether one talks about the hippies in the 60s, etc., we see that many of these co-opt suggestions have short-term but not long-term viability because they either collapse because of internal divisions or external pressure. What I'm curious about is why do you think that these suggestions that you're making have a greater chance of success when historically almost every example that has ever been made has failed?
I would argue, did everybody hear the question? Yeah, okay. I would argue that we have an ever so slightly better chance now, and I will say we, despite the fact that this is purely, you know, my desire and not necessarily one that's shared by everybody. I think that the people who desire this sort of way of living have a slightly better chance now because we have an improved understanding not merely of the history you refer to, but of complex dynamic adaptive systems and their behaviors. If there's one thing we understand, it's that low probability states of a complex system require energy be pumped into that system to sustain themselves. And that energy is very often in human communities crisis. For example, the energy that allowed Occupy Sandy to subsist and produce a very highly ordered and very low probability state of organization and complexity was the energy of crisis, of the urgency of the storm and the lack or the paucity of response to it. And predictably, when that sense of urgency went away, largely so did Occupy Sandy. For those of us who are interested in creating a persistent horizontal infrastructure for the people of New York City, that didn't come as a surprise, but it did come as a disappointment. We now understand that you need to pump some kind of impetus into things. And I think if we understand that dynamic, we can get better at offering people incentives and triggers to action that aren't necessarily crisis-oriented and aren't necessarily the sense of existential threat. Because I think that's a pretty gloomy way to go about doing things. Having said that, I think our times and our circumstances do present us with existential threat. I think that the high energy, high dependency, high interlinkage systems that everyday life relies upon are extraordinarily brittle, extraordinarily fragile. I think we're entering into an era in which we'll have access to fewer and fewer of them. I think that more of our lives will be ordered by more crisis in the global north than has historically been the case for the last 100, 150 years. I think we will learn the skills of adaptation and resilience that people in distressed communities or people in the global south have always turned to organize their communities. And I think if you look at things from that perspective, when you look at the latent social organization of a Getxo Kondo community or a favela community, you see more of the structures that you associate with a kibbutz or with the diggers or with whomever that have evaporated being sustained over time because they're constantly having energy pumped into by external threat. Now, I don't very much like that. I don't think it's a very happy trajectory for Western civilization, but at this particular moment in time, I don't see a lot of alternatives. I don't really think that there's going to be any sense of salvation from the set of circumstances that we've entered into other than the salvation that we ourselves build. And I hope that's a mildly satisfactory answer to a very good question. Thank you.
Hi. Hey. My name is Mike Lenzner. Thanks for the presentation or for the talk. My name is Michael Lenzner. I'm one of the geeks that's been doing hacking that you talk to and hang out with, and my colleagues are like yours, Anthony Townsend and the rest of the guys that do ubiquitous computing for a long time. So I started I've been doing the type of work of hacking built and hacking cities through the dematerialization of stuff for 12, 15 years now. And I agree with some parts of your argument, but I think I feel like it's missing pieces of it and doesn't reflect my experience having and continuing to do this work. So here in Montreal, we have one of the most successful wireless groups in the world called Il Sans Fil. It sets up, we run now 1,200 hotspots probably, all different kinds of places. And we created a system back in 2004 that, we're doing the location-based content, location-based services. What was stopping us was not a hegemonic capitalist, vision, alternate vision of the world that had all the power. What was stopping us was there was no location-based content for us to put on our portal pages. And, very mundane things where the technology, the pieces weren't there. And then, 7 or 8 years later, we have a great community calendar that works because, people are using it, and just like Wikipedia, the conditions are such that it actually exists now and didn't exist, 10 years ago. So, and I see all the community groups that I was part of, then turn into open data movements. And you have, people that continue to learn, like me, geeks continue to learn how to talk to city, how to talk to municipality elected officials in different ways and get what we want. So I think there's a culture piece that I'm interested in what you think about of people learning how to talk with geeks.
Yeah.
And that it's not just characterized as a political fight between geeks and IBM, and more about a slower place where we're educating non-geeks on some of this stuff. And yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a lot packed up in your question. The first thing is that you may not here locally have felt that hegemonic capitalism was the ultimate impediment to your achieving that. I will say that regulatory capture in the United States has meant that open municipal wireless has actually been regulated out of existence in the States. So, and that is very much because there are companies that stand to gain or lose when open ad hoc networks are made available for people. They want to deliver bandwidth to people. And we see the entire terrain of net neutrality becoming contentious precisely for this reason. To your broader point about a culture piece, it's all culture. It's so little of it is technological. But one of the things that I find not particularly useful is the notion of a geek. I'm not a geek. I'm not comfortable with geek culture. I'm not at all. I'm not interested in it. What I'm interested in is capacity. And I think that there are absolute impediments, some of which are literally neurocognitive, to people getting together and learning each other's capabilities, capacities, and life ways in ways that allow them to form functional, effective networks. And we just have to get very, very much more conscious of what those impediments are, very much more patient about it. We're playing a very long game. The clock is ticking and we don't have a great deal of time. But if we're talking about allowing people who have a particular set of aptitudes for a particular and very complicated set of technologies to share the value of that knowledge with people who have absolutely no predilection or interest in it, that is a long, arduous, and ultimately, I think, rewarding effort, but it's not going to happen even in 10 years' time. The other thing that you allude to, though, the failure of the local group about location-based content, part of that may literally be because it's being conceived of as location-based content. I mean, I always find this. I always find that if you ask a group of 100 New Yorkers or 100 Londoners or 100 Paulistas, are you an urbanist? Do you care about urbanism? People say, no, I have no idea what that means. I don't particularly care about it. I don't have any interest in it. But if you ask people, should this street that you live on be blocked to car traffic? Or what do we do about operating hours for the bar and nightclub that's just opened up on your block? Or what do you think about the CCTV camera on the lamppost over there that's capturing your image as you walk past it? All of a sudden, people are passionately invested and interested in these things. And I think framing things, with all due respect, as location-based content, we find time and time, there are location-based content services, commercial, open, they've all failed. Nobody has any interest in them. But the community that I live in has an active community newspaper where people write mail, physical mail letters to the editor about things like lost cats and people breaking into their their back door and stuff like that. So people care about the stuff that's happening in their communities passionately. What the cultural fit that you're looking for is that nobody has managed consistently to explain to them that what they're talking about is location-based content. And, you know, that seems trivial, but it turns out to be decisive. I'm really interested, profoundly interested, in the ways in which your experience maybe doesn't, hopefully not falsify some of the arguments I'm making, but just doesn't mesh with it. And if you'd like to follow up on this, I warmly encourage you to get in touch with me, whether, you know, it's while I'm here or via email afterwards, because, you know, all this talk is, honestly, to all of you, it is an attempt to articulate different possible trajectories for information technology in urban space so that the smart city isn't presented to us as an inevitability and that we have some room to breathe. God knows this is not final, decisive, the set of answers. So I'm very, very much interested in ways in which these ideas could be refined by people who have deeper and more robust actual experience of things than I. Thank you very much.
Hey. Hi, my name is Jimmy. Hi. I'm here as a PhD candidate, and I also work at the Office of Public Consultation of Montreal, where we try to use more and more, sometimes as a 3D printer or augmented reality, virtual reality, and more and more that we're embarking into this. We see that there are different new media that we can use and different type of, and there's a new intelligence you can bring in. And I would like to know, where do you sit in terms of the sentient city or the new media city?
It's garbage.
It's garbage. It's all garbage.
It's sentient. Okay. Yeah, my personal pet peeve is when people use the word sentient to mean self-aware or possessing subjectivity. Yeah. I'm fairly... cities, of course, have consciousness. They always have. You don't need to spackle a city with sensors. That is a representation of that consciousness, but it is not the consciousness itself. This city has a consciousness right now. This room has a consciousness, and we can feel it. We can feel, you know, whether I'm saying things that you find convincing or I'm saying things that you find bullshit. We feel that. What the sentient city as it's being represented to us is a way to try and capture, assess, and quantify that sentiment on an urban scale. And that's not the same thing as going and talking to people. It does different things. It has its uses. It has uses. You can operationalize it. You can materialize it. You can do things with that knowledge. It is power knowledge, but it is not. It produces a different set of effects than going and talking to people, which is ultimately what I believe in. Man, there's so much more to say about that. And if you don't think I've answered your question satisfactorily, again, I encourage you to get in touch. Cheers. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Maxim. So I work between media and urban spaces. And I have a question regarding the ownership of the data.
Yes.
So as a citizen of Montreal, I'm curious if the data should remain in Montreal or should it be pumped by Silicon Valley? Should there be like tax when it go out of the city where I live?
Mm.
And who owns the right to explode that data?
Mm. The openness, transparency, and transmissibility of data is one of those vexatious and thorny questions that I've had a couple of different feelings about over the years. My opinions continue to evolve. I think, you know, the techno-libertarian utopianists of the Californian ideology always used to say that information wants to be free. And there is a limited truth to that. It is true in the sense that if you want network digital information specifically to remain local, you have to create artificial boundaries to its transmissibility. And that's very difficult to do reliably and consistently. Given that it's very difficult to do that, it does appear to me that you can retain some of the social values of that by insisting on radical transparency and radical openness, which for many years was my position. And then I began to attend to some of the feminist thinking of the early 1970s a little bit more. And I began reading, I started with an article called The Tyranny of Structurelessness, and I branched out from there. And I thought about openness and transparency and who openness and transparency are very frequently able to be mobilized by. And if you bring a power analysis to those questions, you find that openness and transparency are mobilized differentially by people who, or by actors, which are already empowered to make use of it. So openness and transparency doesn't flatten the society when we're talking about data. It actually gives organizations like the NSA or like marketers more tools to exploit, more tools to interdict, more tools to interfere. And my final conversion experience was Gamergate, when I saw that the radical transparency that I believed in is capable of being mobilized by sociopaths who direct swarms of sociopathic behavior to harass and to deny social spaces to vulnerable people, or to make people who weren't previously vulnerable feel like they're not welcome in the public square. So we have a bind here where technically it's very difficult to erect limits to things. You can do it in law. Clearly, you know, the European Union has different laws about privacy and data than the United States does. But those laws have always felt very artificial to me and very difficult to maintain. You're creating a class of criminality where there was none before, and you're turning a lot of people willy-nilly into transgressors. And you've had to erect an entire infrastructure of law and regulation that is just very difficult to enforce. And on the other hand, you have the potential where openness is abused and exploited by people with abuse and exploitation at heart. I don't know where this is all going to wind up. And frankly, I think we're going to wind up with a patchwork, a very, very multi-party patchwork of responses to it, none of which is entirely satisfactory. That patchwork in itself may function as a defense against the worst abuses, though. We'll see. Yeah, thank you.
Maybe if I hold the mic, I can ask a question too.
We've gone long.
Take another question if there is after, of course. In a way, we're going to get new gizmos, new artifacts, new networks, new things that are going to come. One of them is the self-driving car.
Yes.
Probably unstoppable. I don't know. One cannot judge. But
nothing's unstoppable.
Nothing is unstoppable. Okay. But there's a good chance, there's a high likelihood that our transportation networks are going to be very dramatically changed by new technology.
Yes.
How do you square something that is really a metropolitan network with a need for some kind of management with your vision of a more community-based grassroots?
What a fantastic question. So Uber. Everybody knows what Uber is. I don't need to describe Uber, but I probably do need to characterize for you what I think Uber is. I think Uber is an interface on top of an algorithm, on top of some fairly exploitive relations, and that's all it is. There's nothing that Uber does that, for example, in my city, Transport for London could not offer. Transport for London, for example, they have operational control over the black cab fleet. They know where every black cab is at every moment of the day. You know, they know that they design APIs. They design user interfaces. Transport for London, a public organization chartered with responsibility for the common well-being, has all of the technical capabilities that Uber, a private organization, which I think is personally, you know, corrosive of social well-being, has deployed to their advantage. So I think that, again, it's almost it goes to the question about geek knowledge. It goes to, do we understand these technologies well enough so that we can demystify them and understand exactly what it is that they are and how they perform, so we can decide, do we want them to be publicly run, publicly operated, privately run, privately operated, or even, you know, the driverless car? I mean, I think that nothing is unstoppable. I do think the driverless car is coming. And it's coming in a very big way. And I think what's particularly interesting about the driverless car is that it will transform our distinctions of the difference between public and private transport. I think the notion of mass public transportation will go away. And that's very sad for people like me. I don't know how the buses and the metros are in this town. In London, we've made a pretty significant investment in them, and they're a very major part of the city's identity. But more than that, they work really well. And it is there are things that you get out of riding buses that you'll never get from riding in an autonomous pod car. You get exposed to difference. You have to, again, there's friction. And that friction is not always delightful. I mean, you know, when I came to the plane to come here, I took a bus to a tube. On the bus, very crowded, through nobody's fault, there happened to be three young parents on that bus at one time with strollers, with buggies, and myself and two other people with luggage for the airport. So that bus was a continual dance of people trying to make the bus space work for us. I get to the tube, and there was a schizophrenic guy in my car in the tube who was picking fights with people, who took off his shoes and socks and stank up the car and scared half the people out of their wits. And so, you know, it was not a great public transit day for me. And nevertheless, you know, for all of those occasional experiences, I'm like, it's awesome. It's, I don't know, maybe I'm perverse. I get such a frisson out of my commitment to publicness in that way. And that's going away. And that's going away. And it's going away because we'll choose convenience and effortlessness over those frictions. And for a lot of people, you know, who am I to insist on friction? You know, I happen to like friction. You may like friction. Most people don't at most times. I understand that. But we need to understand the technology so we understand how to organize what service designers would call the service design around them. There's got to be one more question.
Paul. Last question.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you very much. You used the word beauty, beautiful, several times. And several times when you were looking at pictures, which you could hardly see, you spoke about the beauty of the spaces. Is beauty a driver of the city as you want to see it, or is it a secondary benefit?
Oh, wow. That is a stiletto through my second and third ribs, twisted through 90 degrees. I'm very aesthetically oriented, but I think aesthetics are morals. I think, you know, there's like, you know, a nanometer's worth of difference between as befits somebody who actually enjoys the friction of public transport. I think that is beautiful, and I find aesthetic pleasure in that. Now, in my own comportment, in my own life, I live in a white cube. I live in a minimalist space that most of you would regard as sterile and cold. I listen to, you know, transcendental black metal, you know, music that most of you would regard as little better than a dentist's drill. I don't mean to impose my aesthetics on anybody else, but I do have one particular sense of the beauty of complexity and difficulty that I will make an argument to you that many people recognize at a relatively deep level, whether or not they are consciously attuned to aestheticizing it and understanding it as beauty. I grew up in Philadelphia in the very tail end of the 1960s and very early 1970s. And there was a patchwork of community organizations, perhaps like the ones you're referring to, the American Friends Service Committee, the Mariposa Food Co-op. You know, you could do healthcare, you could do daycare, you could do, you know, a great many of the things that life required of us through these, I think of them as a hippie technology. They were a hippie technology complex in a very strange way. And they were visually not very appealing, none of them. I mean, we were just up in your office just now, and I was rhapsodizing about, you know, these wicker chairs and these old banker's boxes and these things which are not beautiful artifacts by any measure, but there's something in, you know, in Canada, you don't talk about the melting pot. You talk about the gorgeous mosaic. You know, the melting pot is a very American idea. And the gorgeous mosaic is a very, much closer to what I'm getting at. There is this aesthetic of the compromised that I find ultimately very invigorating. And I think a lot of people, based on my experiences in Philadelphia as a small child, A lot of people find something, it reflects something in themselves, and they take a great deal of personal satisfaction and fulfillment from it. Whether or not it looks like one of those renderings of, you know, a perfect, brilliant glass and steel cubicle, I think there is a beauty in it, and it's a very resonant and profound beauty.
Well, thank you very, very much. Let us give our speaker another round. I think you helped us end our week on a high note.
Oh,
thank you very, very much.
Privilege.
Very inspiring talk, which is leaving us with many images, metaphors. Certainly you have an extraordinary CV in terms of life trajectory involving U.S. Army and Nokia.
I have a short attention span, that's all there is to it.
A super busy person. But it's wonderful that you brought, I think, the richness of your experience and of your outlook on life to us in a talk that was dealing with a specific topic.
Oh.
So thank you very, very much.
Thank you kindly. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to be here. Thank you.